All righty. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Brian Tremont. I'm the Managing Partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer here in Washington, D.C., and the Chair of the Telecommunications and Media Practice Group at the Federalist Society. I would be remiss if I did not invite you to join the practice group. We would love to have you on board. Really dynamic sector right now, as illustrated by today's panel. So please look us up. Today, we're discussing the largest ever federal infusion of broadband funding by an order of magnitude. More money is being poured in this sector than ever has been by maybe 10 times what the FCC has historically invested. It's a huge opportunity for the country, and there's a lot of piece parts that we're going to explore in today's panel with our excellent experts. Our moderator today is the Honorable Jeffrey Sutton, who assumed the position of Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in May of 2021. Judge Sutton was nominated to the court by President George Bush and confirmed by the Senate in 2003. He earned his law degree from the Ohio State University College of Law. Wonderful Ohio State victory this week. Yeah, the Ohio State, sorry.
Don't miss that.
And subsequently clerked on the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, as well as two Supreme Court justices, Lewis Powell, as well as Antonin Scalia. Chief Judge Sutton served as Solicitor General of Ohio from 1995 to 1998, and also spent time in private practice. He has also served as an adjunct professor of law at the Ohio State University College of Law and as a visiting lecturer at Harvard. Chief Judge Sutton has authored books and articles on a wide variety of topics, including state constitutional law and federalism. Before his confirmation to the court, he argued 12 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and numerous cases in state Supreme Courts, as well as the Federal Courts of Appeal. He serves as the chair of the Judicial Conference of the U.S. Committee on Rules of Practice and Procedure and serves as the chair of the Advisory Committee on Appellate Rules. With that, I will turn it over to Judge Sutton, who's going to moderate our discussion today.
All right. Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here. It's great to be with this panel. I'm not a broadband expert, so I'm going to give you my perspective on it, which is a tale of two types of communities in Ohio. I live in Columbus, Ohio, and I would say in Ohio, when it comes to broadband, you have an urban-suburban story and a rural story. So the urban-suburban story, my story, Columbus, goes something like this. I'm horrified by broadband access. I'm horrified by what the internet's doing to us. And things have gotten so bad that with my last year's group of law clerks, I decided we are going to have no tech Tuesdays and Thursdays, where literally you could not have your phones, you couldn't use your computer, you couldn't word process, you had to use the U.S. reports three-dimensionally. You had to print things, you had to buy a pencil, paper. They said, Judge, we can't possibly do all the work you're asking us to do without access to the internet on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Can we just do it Tuesday, Thursday morning? I'm like, okay, fine. That's good enough. So we did that last year. This year's clerks heard about this and tried to pretend it wasn't going to happen. And finally, I said, what's going on? You know, Ethan Beck, I put in charge of this project, my broadband expert. And I said, Ethan, come on, when are we going to get this going? He says, the clerks, we don't think we can do the job without this. I said, okay, we'll do just one day. It'll be Friday. So Friday mornings, so far, no tech. They put their phones in the kitchen galley. They print things out. They do their work without access to the internet. So that's the Columbus suburban urban story. Now you have the rural story in Ohio, which would be they wait till Friday afternoon, and then they all go to the parking lot of the library to find out what happened on the internet. So Zoom classes are at McDonald's library parking lots, where of course they have no broadband access. So there's definitely a tale of two sets of communities in Ohio. I'm pretty sure it's two sets of communities throughout the country. We have billions of dollars being thrown at this problem. For better, for worse, we'll find out. I think that's really the point of the conversation. And we've got three great experts to talk about it. The Honorable Michael Riley will present first. He's a former commissioner of the FCC, runs his own consulting company, and he's going to have the perspective of the national side, which I assume you support a lot of what the national government's doing, but maybe wonder about the guardrails. It'd be my guess, not 100% sure. Shirley Bloomfield, who's really an expert on rural access, I would say, and the CEO of NTCA, the Rural Broadband Association. So she's got expertise nationally, works out of DC, but really focused on rural access. And then my favorite, because I love the states and every state employee and every state agency, Vineeth Iyengar, who is head of Louisiana's broadband program. So he's going to give the perspective from a state with plenty of urban and rural communities. So why don't we start, Mike, with you? We'll do traditional format of, you know, roughly 8 minutes per person. We'll talk a little among ourselves. I'll have a few questions and then plenty of questions from you all. We're actually not going to go till 2:15. One of the four of us has a flight at 3:20. It won't be hard to guess which one it is when 2 o'clock hits. all right. Thank you for being here, Mike.
Well, thank you, Judge, and thank you to the Federal Society for having me and the telecom practice as well. Much appreciated. I don't have a speech. I'm going to give my comments about the topic at hand and hopefully not overrun my time. I'm so proud to be part of this panel with some very experts on the subject. I think we're going to get into it as we did in our prep call. So I'm excited on where we're going to go. When I look at the topic, and how it's been framed, I would make the argument, you know, is this the biggest investment in federal broadband, or is it a waste of money? And my answer is yes, it's both. I agree with both premises. There is a need for more broadband federal dollars. There has been. I worked extensively at the FCC to invest the scarce USF dollars in extending broadband to those communities that don't have it today, and there's still a need. How big that need is, we'll get it to a comment about the end, but there's a need, and you can debate on how big it is. There's certainly many parts of rural America that don't have broadband as we would define it today, and we need to figure out how best to go about it. Congress stepped in and said, we're gonna answer this issue. And they've done it in a number of different statutory frameworks. The biggest one by far is the infrastructure bill. IIJA put $42.45 billion, which is, as mentioned by my previous speakers, it's 10 times the amount of money the FCC puts in yearly on broadband access. About 4.5 out of the FCC. This is 42.45. But you can't miss that there are money coming out of the Treasury at $10 billion directly, money coming out of U.S. Ag Department, depending, a couple billion, depending on how you're counting and what the year is and how much money is going out. But you know, you're talking a pot of money that's directly for broadband. That's probably give or take $60 to $75 billion. And then you add on that all of the money that's been allocated to states that can be used for broadband. And there's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. Most of that will not be used for broadband and hasn't been used for broadband, but there's a lot of money available that could be used for broadband. And then you have the direct funding that I'm talking about now. And I'll spend more of my time talking about the NTIA program because it's so large and gonna be so impactful to our colleagues on the panel. I didn't agree with everything that was written regarding the NTIA, Department of Commerce, infrastructure, $42.45 billion. I didn't agree with everything, but Congress gets to make those decisions. That I spent 20 years of my life working for Congress, 11 years in the Senate, and 9 years in the House as a staffer. So I have to defer to the experts and the decisions that they made. They put this money available. I didn't agree with certain things. Though I love block grants and have established them in so many other frameworks, I didn't, and testified to the fact, I didn't think broadband block grants were gonna be the best mechanism to go forward and to distribute these dollars. And if you wanna look to how block grants have worked, we had an example. You've got New York State, where the FCC basically gave them a block grant, and then the state itself figured out how they're gonna spend their dollars. And if you wanna know how it worked out, well, my former part, I'm from Buffalo, and the Western New York part was designated as satellite. And the rest of the state, most of the state, including the Adirondacks, which is incredibly difficult to hike, got fiber. And you say, well, how is that possible? And you go, that's New York. That's New York politics. They don't like Western New York. They never liked Western New York. And they're not gonna spend their dollars in Western New York. And so that's what happens. You know, that was my experience. That's a tangible experience. You know, and there are many of them. That's not just one. I can go through NARUC and some of the ETC status and different things. I've got a long litany of experiences in this space to go through. But there's just one example of the problems with block grants. And we know out of 50 states, some will do it very well, some will do it mediocre, and some are going to do an incredibly poor job at this. And so we ask the question, is it going to be wasteful? And the answer is absolutely yes. there's a good chance, and I've measured it, and you know, I've calculated based on past experience, I'm putting the number at 30%. 30% of $42.45 billion, in my opinion, is going down the drain. That still means 70% is going where we want it, and we'll do really good work for that purpose. But that's a lot of money being wasted. So then we get to some of the problems with, you know, I mentioned one of the block grants, but I'm gonna get to some of the other issues. One is that the agencies themselves are ignoring the law. They're ignoring language that was put in the statute. The agencies that are in charge of implementing such a big pot of money, namely NTIA and Department of Commerce, are ignoring a couple of different components. One, it says it has to be technology neutral. Absent, you know, the most egregious circumstances, it has to be technology neutral. And so NTIA says, you know what? We really like fiber. Let's put our finger down, our hand down, our head down, everything on the side of the scale of fiber. Look, I love fiber. I'm not an anti-fiberist, if that's a word. I don't really suggest otherwise. But that's one, it's a congressional decision. And two, I know it's going to take other technologies, and we're going to hear from others that are going to work on these issues. It's going to take other technologies to get there. We've done that at the commission. We know the experiences. Fiber is not going to go to every community in America, and it shouldn't. And we also hear the argument that, well, fiber is foolproof. Well, that's funny, because now we're hearing a lot more arguments on how fiber is not foolproof. It needs to be replaced, give or take, every 20 years, in terms of the installation was done wrong, in terms of what, you know, what capabilities are. So fiber is not foolproof, as people think it is. Like, put it in once, never have to do it again. It's copper twisted pairs, the old days of POTS. That's not true. It's going to have more investment. So you're buying yourself some more time at an exorbitant cost. So you have to make those decisions, and now Congress has asked the states to make those decisions. The agencies also placed a number of conditions that had nothing to do with broadband, deal with labor issues, deal with all kinds of different sub-political issues that it wanted to do and it wanted to implement as part of its goal. I'm surprised it didn't do climate change on top of it, because that's kind of the direction it wanted. You know, if you want these dollars to be spent efficiently, well, you don't add these other conditions that have nothing to do really with broadband and drive up the cost. And we know this is true. We know my point is true, because Congress came forward and the people who actually wrote this provision of statute said, that's wrong. You're doing it wrong. I wrote that language in negotiation with the Secretary of Commerce, and you're doing it wrong. And the agency go, such is life. God bless you. So what does that mean for the upcoming Congress? And we don't know what Congress is going to look like. Now, you know, we just had an election. We'll take a look at every day. Every hour, I kind of look and see what's it going to look like. But one thing that's going to be necessary is massive oversight. No matter who's in charge, you need massive oversight. That's the point I'll be making to the new Congress as we go forward. We need congressional hearings. We need constant inquiry to the agency to make sure the dollars are going where they're supposed to go and actually getting people connected versus other agenda items or enriching people. Because we know from our experience, and there's been, you know, anyone who's old enough has done 2009 BTOP. You've lived through the experience of the dollars being wasted and coming out of that going, wow, that was a really inefficient use of dollars. We need to make sure that doesn't happen again with this massive amount of money. Another problem that hasn't been solved and won't be solved in the near term is a lack of coordination between the agencies. I mentioned the different federal programs that are out there or who's in control of the dollars. Well, they're not talking to each other. You can mandate they talk, you can mandate they sit at this table every Friday. It's not gonna get coordination. Coordination doesn't mean talking, it means actually making sure the programs fit well together. And they're not right now. And what you're going to get, in my opinion, is overbuilding. You're gonna get one agency doing one thing, another agency doing another thing. You may get two recipients of federal dollars in parts of rural America for the same area that we know can't be sustained for one provider. How does that go forward? What does that make any sense? And what does that mean for the future of broadband in the areas that don't have enough dollars? Because we're gonna run out of dollars at some point. And there's probably not going to be, in my opinion, another pot of money like this in the next 10 years. Maybe it's longer. But in 10 years, we're not gonna see another pot of money. We know that the new Congress is gonna have a different perspective, and we're gonna go into 2024 with a slightly different perspective. It's never gonna be the same as it was when the infrastructure bill was drafted. It's always, you know, that was the high water mark, in my opinion, in terms of investment. And so when someone says, I need more money, that's gonna be, you know, scrutinized even better and even more than based on this experience, based on these dollars and how the states handle them. We also need to do, and I'll leave two parts to end my conversation. One is the bill and the law and our experiences so far have not dealt with deployment issues. We know that if you want broadband out there, it's not just about getting buying fiber or buying the technology. We know that deployment is really difficult. If you want to invest in, and you want to stretch lines across very difficult areas that don't have it today and are very expensive, well, you need to use current infrastructure in some regards. You're using the current poles, you're using rights of way. And many of those instances today, those who own those rights and way, those who own those poles are not being cooperative. And there is no corresponding provision in the law to deal with that. We're going to have to address it. And I mentioned we have a good representative from Louisiana. I was in New Orleans a couple years ago, and I'll tell you a little story. We had new wireless towers being built in New Orleans for broadband purposes. It was a wholesaler building them and extending them out to provide broadband to areas that didn't have anything, and they couldn't get power. We couldn't even get because the local power company was thinking, how can I be a provider? I want to figure out how to do this. So I'm going to spend as long as I want, and I'll figure out how to get power to them someday. Maybe I won't. And who's going to tell me to do otherwise, right? And that's a big problem that has to be addressed, whether it be done statutorily or done by different regulatory bodies, including my old shop. The last one is how these dollars are going to be distributed. And we're going to know that, some regards, in the next week or so, we're going to see new mapping. The maps of the FCC have been problematic for so long. I was part of that process. I pushed for better maps. And now we're going to see our first iteration of those maps next week. No one in this crowd or any right-leaning group should be too critical of these maps. They're not intended to be the final product. They're going to be better than anything we've seen before. And that's going to be helpful for the purpose. But at the same time, they're going to get better. And that's because there's a challenge process implemented, something I pushed for when I was in the FCC, for other federal dollars that have been spent in the past. And so we're going to get the maps. They're going to get, they're going to be better than anything can. And in 6 months or so, it's probably going to be late Q2, we're going to have maps that are going to be the best thing that ever existed. They're still going to have flaws. We have to accept the fact that even, open up an atlas, open up a map, and there are inaccuracies. There are going to be inaccuracies in the map overall. And we have to accept that fate. We're trying to build the best map possible, and these will be the best maps ever built before for our purpose. Old maps were not built for this purpose. These maps will improve by a factor of 10 or greater. So better maps are coming, and we should be mindful that people who are trying to tear down maps and say, no, these maps are terrible, we need to restart the process and ignore these, and let me just spend my money. I'm a state, or I'm a regulatory body, or I'm a potential recipient. Let me figure this out. We don't need to use those maps that aren't perfect. Let me do something else. And that's the wrong approach, in my opinion. We have so much work to do, so many grappling issues to be had going forward, and I'll be commenting on them both on events like this, and also probably in the U.S. Congress as the committees get to work in their massive oversight. So with that, I hope that will lead to a lot of conversation after my colleagues present. Thanks so very much.
All right, good afternoon. So I'm Shirley Bloomfield. I head up NTCA, the World Broadband Association, and I think it's actually fitting that we're having this discussion just about a year to the date of the signing of the Infrastructure Act. So I think your timing is impeccable. But I'm delighted to join this group because I know that I'm going to learn a lot. But just let me take 1 minute to say a little bit about who NTCA is. So we're a national trade association. We represent 850 community-based telecom providers across the country. These are folks who traditionally were the telephone company in their communities and grew up to become the broadband companies, and we're actually able to pivot to provide that technology even faster than a lot of the large carriers because they're community-based, which means your neighbors are your customers. And when you're not providing the service that people are looking for, they're catching you at church or at the grocery store. And my companies serve about 35% of the landmass of the United States, about 6% of the population. We hear so much about the digital divide, the rural divide. I really look at it through the prism of there's a rural-rural divide. There is a rural America that is served by community-based providers that really have every incentive to ensure that their kids' school has access to broadband and connectivity, that their parents who are going to that local health clinic have telemedicine options. But there's also rural America that traditionally has also been served by a lot of large carriers that, frankly, when they have the opportunity to make their investment choices, they are doing what the markets dictate, and probably rightly so, and putting their money into their competitive markets, which has really led to the position that we're in right now as we are looking at how we make sure, per Congress's wishes, that we connect all Americans. And I do think that, you know, in the world of if there was one silver lining of COVID, it was actually that recognition that connectivity is important, and where you live makes it more challenging. And, you know, I know from the experience of working with my providers how challenging it is in a rural market, how expensive it is in a rural market. My folks have 6 customers per square mile of their service territory on average, which means, frankly, in Montana, you may have less than 1. But you think about that infrastructure that is in place here in Washington, D.C. It's the same infrastructure whether you're in Montana, you're downtown D.C. The real difference is the number of people you're connecting, which means the number of people you have to spread those costs among. So again, historic opportunity right now, which is why we're having this conversation. Is this, you know, going to be a great bust, or is this going to be a great opportunity? I tend to be very bullish. I tend to think this is a moment in time where we as a country have really made this decision to come together to actually really invest, that we've recognized what connectivity means in terms of e-commerce, in terms of valuations, in terms of the ability to you know, do all of the services that we know are so important, whether it's education, whether it is healthcare, and thinking through those things. The challenge also becomes, however, how do we not only look to build, and this money, while Mike laid it out, is historic and it's a lot. It will not come again. I completely agree with that. And it will not cover everybody. I think that's the other recognition that policymakers are going to have to get their arms around, that at the end of the day, when we are done, we will still have people who are unconnected. But we also need to make sure that whatever we do with this funding, that we are building sustainable networks, that we have the ability to actually not just put money in the ground and walk away and think that we've got an infrastructure here that's going to be sustainable, but that we also make it affordable, because frankly, the value of the networks is really about getting a number of people on it. So, you know, Mike went through the key programs. You know, you've already got, you know, ARPA money going out there through the states. They've already been active on a number of fronts, depending on what state you are in. You've got Treasury, you've got Reconnect through the Department of Agriculture, and you've got BEAD coming down the pike. So I'll just share some things that I think are good. It's a lot of money. I think we've got an opportunity to do some really good things. I probably differ from Mike in a little bit in that I actually think setting the bar high is really important. I think we have an opportunity to do this right, the first go around. I'm actually going to be down at the Corning plant on Tuesday, and I think they would probably say that fiber will last you significantly longer than 20 years, but I'll come back after my tour. And the other thing that I would say is that when you think about what technology you put in place, you're thinking about not just the CapEx of what that infrastructure is, but think about the OpEx. And for my parts of the country, the OpEx is when you are driving 3 hours, my guys call it windshield time when you're in New Mexico, you know, to do a truck roll. You know, you've got a troubleshoot that you are doing. It is the amount of time and effort that also takes place. And what we are finding is that obviously the OpEx is a lot lower. Just as a point of reference, my member companies, again, you know, picturing that 35% of the landmass, over 78% of their customer base has access to fiber to the home technology. And again, that really comes with, you know, being that provider that knows that the future vitality of your community, frankly, the life of your community, depends on the ability to connect to the rest of the world. Also, I think the other things that were done right is there was a real focus on unserved. Let's hit those Americans first. There's a reason they are unserved, because it is expensive to reach them. So that emphasis that was made on unserved and underserved, I think, is really important, as opposed to like how many competitors can we get in one market, and, you know, isn't that great? Because if you can't make a business case, you simply can't make a business case. I also think it's very interesting watching the flow of the money, as Mike noted. Most of the money, Treasury, will go down to the states. USDA, it'll come from the federal level. But BEAD, the huge chunk of money, will go down through the states. Folks like Beneath will be working through some of those processes. States should know better, right? You're on the ground, you're local, you're a little bit closer to the action. You've got a sense of where your communities are, and you've got a sense of who's kind of been left behind. But that being said, there's also obviously some execution risks. And just kind of hitting through that, More money, more problems, right? You throw a lot of money, you got, I can't begin to tell you the number of vendors that are calling me being like, I've got the solution. Like, who are you? These companies that are popping up, because that's just the way it rolls. You start talking about $60 billion and you're gonna have a lot of folks out there. Coordination, absolutely. You've got a lot of agencies. Not only do you have at least three federal agencies, but then you've got states. And the states will have their own broadband offices. They are all set up differently. And then you've got NTIA who will have a state person in each state. That's a lot of coordination, and that's going to be certainly a challenge. You're also going to, all these programs have different standards. They have different speed requirements. They have different timelines. That is going to be something that is going to have to be synchronized. You've also got provisions that I think are going to be challenging, like Buy America. You know, again, it's a great concept. It's truly wonderful. It is really tough when you are buying any kind of software or hardware to ensure that you are able to have all of that. And frankly, some of the components, it's pretty hard to track down and say where they actually came from. We also see a huge issue right now in supply chain. My companies are a year out in their ability to get access to fiber, you know, optic cabling in particular, handholds and some of the other pieces of equipment there. You know, it truly has become the new toilet paper. They're hoarding. My guys have a year supply that they are hoarding. God knows where they are hoarding it. But they know that when they put an order in today, they are being told it's going to take a year. Well, those are some things that we as a country need to be thinking about what we can do on that. Regulatory barriers. You'd be amazed how hard it is to go through railroad crossings. If anybody here represents railroad companies, I'm really sorry, but holy cow, that is one of the biggest obstacles. And I know it sounds silly, but it is really amazing. So when you think about that, I think about Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, you know, the permits that people have to go through when they are saying, I'm out in Wyoming and I need to go from Cheyenne to Silver Star, what those challenges are and how we make that a little bit easier. And then I think something that isn't totally sexy, but I think is really important to be thinking about is workforce and access to the workforce. We've got this momentous amount of money coming down the pike. My companies can't even find the workers to do what they're doing right now. Start thinking about $60 billion going out the door at the same time. I think about it in particular because it's going to be more attractive for people to take that job in Minneapolis than it might be to take it in Dickinson, North Dakota. But thinking about how we develop that workforce, how we make young people think about jobs being cool in this area. And fascinatingly enough, I just had a discussion this morning with the folks from the Eastport Association talking about, you know, how the future IT workers of America really are going to become, you know, from the gaming community on some of these esport teams. So again, you know, I think there's going to be different flavors. The state offices, I'm fascinated to hear what Neith has to say, because I think each state that I work with, the diversity in the skill set of who is taking on this mantle and what their experience is and what their perspective is and how willing they are to talk to providers and to communities and to anchor institutions really varies. And I think that's going to make it very, very important. And I also think oversight is going to be huge. So if there's some pieces of good news I would leave you with, Congress really mandated that the maps have to come before the money. That is the mantra, and I think it's a really important mantra. It's going to take longer than anybody's going to like, but I think the opportunity to try to do this right is going to be more important than doing it fast. So I think there's going to be a lot of coordination, right? You're going to have USDA is already pumping money out there. The FCC has already got some programs out there. There's going to have to be some discipline and some diligence about where those locations are that get roped into what we are seeing going on. And I would just conclude with, you know, again, going back to the sustainability, back to the fact that we don't want to sit there and say, we put all this money in the ground, good for us, job done. And that is where I think things like the Universal Service Fund is so very important to make sure that these networks are sustainable. Mike, when he sat at the FCC, was very key in 2018 in ensuring that some reforms were done to keep this program moving forward. I think there is more future setting that needs to happen, and we need to be thinking about contribution reform. But it is a program, some of you may know it because of schools and libraries, some of you may know it because of high costs, some of you may have, you know it for Lifeline. But this is a program that really allows, it's a cost recovery program. For my companies, it is frankly what builds the business model to make that broadband build in the first place. So I think as we think forward and we think about contribution reform, all of those things will be very, very important. And last, we're just continuing to think about what kind of tools we can help provide to at least educate as many people as possible about what the opportunities are, what the challenges are. We put together a toolkit that we have shared with all of our partners in the state broadband offices, basically saying, look, we know a lot about what it takes to put broadband into these high-cost markets. Here's some thoughts that we have. We also have a state tracker that we're working with ACA on to basically be able to share in real time, you know, what is Louisiana doing and how does that compare with Illinois and who's got Buy American provisions and who has, you know, different labor provisions. And the ability to be able to compare when that money starts coming down the pike, I think is going to be important. And again, most importantly, I think it will be to keep sure that we are making sure that we're all having these conversations, because I think the more that we're sharing with one another as these things roll out, I think the smoother the process will go. So thank you.
Thank you, folks. Thank you, FedSoc, for inviting us. But I want to say two things before I share the Louisiana story. The first is, today is a really important day in Louisiana, but throughout the country. Louisiana itself, we have 288,000 veterans who have been instrumental in Louisiana's success, but more so the country's success. So really a tip of the hat to all those veterans who continue to drive our country. Second is, how many of y'all are college football fans? I hope you watched the Alabama go down this past Saturday. Yeah, I am not wearing this because I am a supporter of Crimson Tide. I wore my purple tie last night, but I would like Alabama to be Ole Miss tomorrow. So the LSU can clinch the SEC West and play Georgia. But let me share the Louisiana story, because I just think it's important when we talk about broadband from a both speed and execution, but also in terms of working with a sense of urgency. We have to, frankly, work at the same level of urgency that people need high-speed, affordable internet that's also reliable. I think what we learned before the pandemic was that, frankly, broadband speeds were episodic at best, not necessarily reliable. And what we learned during the pandemic was that when everyone's home, what did we face? You guys all are probably fathers, grandfathers, you have siblings, and what were y'all doing, possibly fighting over maybe at 5, 6, 7 p.m. when everyone was using the same device, similar devices? You're like, Johnny, stop watching Netflix. Stop doing something else. That was a very, very big problem. Very big problem. And so what happened in Louisiana was this. In 2019, in Q3, Q4 of 2019, the governor created, through an executive order, the Broadband for Everyone in Louisiana Commission, with the singular goal of eliminating the digital divide in Louisiana by 2029. Before that commission could ever really get off the ground, pandemic hit in March. And what was really interesting then was it took a hyper-aligned effort between the governor and the legislature, and it took an accelerated effort to not only stand up and create legislation to create the Office of Broadband in 2020, but also within 18 months, we've not only committed $170 million, but we're well on our way to trying to solve this digital divide by 29, if not sooner. And I'll tell you a couple of key things that happened during that process. The reason why we've been, at least from a public startup perspective, and that's what we are, frankly, and that's what every state broadband office is, except maybe Virginia and North Carolina and a couple of states that had broadband offices, we're all effectively public startups. There are only three people in our office. So bureaucracy really doesn't exist. But one of the things that we frankly do a really good job of in Louisiana, because it's part of our cultural ethos as an office, is it is incumbent upon us that if we're trying to address the digital divide in Louisiana, we can't just talk to the folks that live in urban areas, but we have to talk to folks in rural areas. Not only do we have to talk to folks in rural areas, but we also have to talk to farmers, healthcare professionals, teachers, students, librarians, superintendents, public safety, community colleges and others. Why? Because they all have a slightly different use case on the need for high-speed, affordable, reliable internet. So the office was created, and the office was created by legislators who lived in rural communities, one that lived in central part of Louisiana and the one that lived in southeast part of Louisiana. The governor, Governor John Bel Edwards, lives in a rural, is from a rural part of Louisiana. So there was a pain, there was an alignment in the pain points that these three folks had in terms of addressing the challenges, right? And so that was step one. Step two, the governor and the legislature said, hey, Vineet, this broadband thing is going to be really a big issue. There's no one there to coordinate this effort, especially coordinating federal, state, and local efforts. And is this something you're willing to do? And I said, sure. Really didn't know a whole lot about broadband. But one of the things that we started, again, consciously doing was spending a significant amount of time on the road. You probably have driven 7,000, 8,000 miles over the last month and a half, 2 months. We go to every nook and cranny. We go to small villages that have maybe 150, 200 people. We go to big towns. And what a typical week in our office looks like is we'll get up at 5 a.m., 6 a.m., we hit the road. We'll drive 3.5 hours northwest to Shreveport area, which is along near the Texas-Arkansas border. We'll drive to Monroe, which is the corporate headquarters for Lumen. And we'll typically cover 4 or 5 different parishes and then come home late that night. We'll do something very similar in southwest Louisiana, something very similar in southeast Louisiana. And you start to see the concentric circles between the challenges and pain points that people from a variety of socioeconomic different backgrounds have. And they all consistently have issues around access, affordability, literacy, digital skills, and devices. In aggregate, Louisiana has about 4.5 million people. 1.5 million people lack access to internet. One out of every three people. 47% of whom are Latinos and African Americans. So what does that actually mean, though? To the farmer, he can't improve operating expenses because he doesn't have, in this case, cellular coverage to run his million-dollar combines. To the small business, their inability to increase productivity, add employment, which are really the two key tenets of growing an economy, can happen because they don't have the ability to do credit card processing. Right? And I think we've heard the stories between the challenges that students and parents and teachers had with schooling. So from our perspective, with the federal money that is either here in Louisiana, and in Louisiana, look, we're fortunate, not only politically we have alignment on this issue, but tactically as well. We have $342 million in RDOF money. That's going to impact 175,692 locations, 13 providers. With the exception of Starlink, 80% of those locations are going to be fiber to the premise. And all have received, again, with the exception of Starlink, they're ready to authorize. So they're getting their monthly checks. Our $176 million is coming from U.S. Treasury. We've already committed $170 million. They all typically have a two-year timeline, and all of the companies that have applied have intended, or they will intend, to build fiber to the premise. 92% of those locations are going to be households, 8% small businesses. Because it's really important for small businesses to be a part of this whole broadband ecosystem. And now we look at getting ready for the infrastructure bill, right? And so a couple of things we are doing with regards to the infrastructure bill and getting ready for it. First is we did submit a significant number of challenges to the fabric, to the FCC fabric. In fact, we submitted approximately 40,000 locations that we felt were missing. And we had a great dialogue with the FCC saying, hey, this is our methodology, this is why they're missing, and they're going to go through the adjudication process of whether to validate those. The second swim lane in preparation for the infrastructure bill, based on the behavior of investing the $170 million thus far from Treasury, is we need to get ahead of the curve and be really aggressive on workforce. So late last year, We strongly encouraged all the internet service providers to partner with local community colleges to start developing local workforce plans. So start to develop the relationships and the connective tissue between the providers and the community colleges. And so we now have several community colleges throughout Louisiana that offer a variety of different classes with regards to fiber splicing and so on and so forth. In fact, we do regional roundtables, and one of the things that we are going to start to see downward pressure on is a little bit less so on the construction, but suddenly we need a lot of people to install services, right? So we're now trying to quickly boot up a number of programs involving installation of actual broadband when someone places an order. The third is permitting. I know you are you clap your hands when you talk about railroads. I'll tell you something about railroads. So we've been very purposeful in engaging with railroads. And in fact, with anyone that touches permitting. And so we, working with the governor's office, we actually convened a permitting meeting with the ISPs, with the co-ops, with the Public Service Commission, with the railroad operators. And what the railroad operators told us was this. They said, look, Vineeth, we don't have millions of, this is what they say, okay? We don't have millions of people sitting doing permitting all day. But if you help us flag that some of these projects that are going to be funded by federal dollars to go into rural areas to provide high-speed affordable broadband, we will be willing to work with them to expedite it. Okay, and when they say expedite, now that's what they say. And now we have all Class A1 rails, so we have all the big players, and we have a number of short line. Now we're gonna have to test that, right, over the next couple of years. But one of the ways we will test that is we're going to be as aggressive as possible in our office. Once we issue grant agreements with all the providers, we're going to actually take those providers and bring them to the parishes that they are going to be bringing high-speed broadband. And what we're going to do is we're going to basically say, hey, parish officials, we're going to bring all the folks responsible for local right-of-ways, local permitting, etc. We're going to ensure that they understand what the timeline and the build timelines are going to be for the ISPs, and vice versa. We're going to also ask the ISPs to say, look, how do we start to gin up local workforce efforts specific to that parish? How do we start to get ahead of this curve? Because the last thing I want, frankly, is a call from a company saying permitting is slowed down by parish officials. And so we're trying to get ahead of that as aggressively as possible. And there'll be accountability measures on all sides, frankly, between us, ISPs, and the parishes to ensure that we try to expedite a lot of this work as quickly as possible. So that's the approach we're taking. It is very much a ground game, tactical approach. We are absolutely a big believer in process improvement. We've gone through two regular legislative sessions in which we created our grant program last year, affectionately known as Gumbo, because it is Louisiana and we need something with a food acronym, but there is a lot of fiber in the real gumbo. There's a lot of fiber in the projects we funded too. So we created the gumbo framework last year that were the mechanics to which to spend this money. We learned a lot between last year and April of this year. We made some legislative tweaks to the gumbo program, such as the following. We have now redefined speeds to 100 by 20. That's one. The second of all, based on hearing from constituents, there was a lot of frustration with the quality of customer service that internet service providers were providing. And so now, the parish officials now have the opportunity, based on if the ISB has a DRF in the Better Business Bureau, to flag and tell us, hey, Vineeth, I don't want that company to service us because their customer service really is not very. So we're trying to engage the locals as much as we can through an iterative process, legislatively and otherwise. And then the last thing is, you know, a couple of months ago, and we were fortunate, we were the first state in the country to get already pre-approved for our BEAD initial planning funds and our digital equity planning funds. We were approved a couple of months ago, I think August 31st. So we're really knee deep in developing the five-year plan initial proposal. We're you know, we're targeting an end of year, January, not necessarily submission, but to get to a point where we actually start to share that with the folks at NTIA. But from our perspective, yes, we want to get this stuff done right. But from our perspective, surely it's all about also process improvement. So as soon as we hear real-time feedback from folks, we try to quickly bubble that up through legislative action, next year being a fiscal year, fiscal session, and at the national level. So that's been our approach. I think it's been helpful. I think it's worked thus far. There's substantially a lot of things that we still don't know, and we will continue to sort of noodle on it and really experiment, try something. If it doesn't work, go back to the drawing board and then keep going before we start to really see the big serious money. So appreciate it.
Mike and Shirley, do you want to respond a little bit to each other, and then Vineet, you'll have a chance to respond to them before we go into other questions.
Oh, you're the honorable. Go ahead.
Yes.
Well, I took some notes on Shirley's presentation. I didn't disagree with a lot of what she had to say. I mean, I think the difficulty that it's, when I heard everything, the difficulty, one issue that I know that she cares deeply about is the OPEX issue in the long term. And that's not addressed in, it's not addressed in the statute, and there's no money for it. And if people want to lump that onto USF, well, they better figure out where that money's coming from, which is already a big problem in and of itself. So I think that's a really difficult. I couldn't agree more with a lot of things that she said in terms of railroads. I've heard, you know, so much. I spent time on problems of railroads, and the permitting issue is just, you know, we talked about permitting. There was a fight in the Congress towards the end, and then maybe still determine in the lame duck on permitting for energy companies. But we need some permitting reform for telecom companies. And there was a great example that was referenced in the story yesterday. Altice is trying to figure out how do we deal with some of the aerial pole problems. And they're contemplating digging instead. Four times the cost to dig than it is to put over poles. But the process is just so much, so uncertain that they'd rather go that route than. Permitting is going to be a massive issue. So I agree with a lot of what Shirley had, you know, said. I don't think, and the difficulty with the company she represents, that she knows this well from my perspective, is they're not capable, they're not going to grow and serve all of the rural areas that are in need. The areas are too big, and they're served by some incumbents that haven't invested over the years, and her companies just aren't going to grow that area. So they're going to have to be served by others. And one thing that hasn't been talked about amongst all the panels is we have a lot of capital being invested by PE, but private equity is being invested. I think there's a great rate of return here. I'm going to return on the dollars you're getting from Congress. I'm going to, you know, have an investment in your company, and I'll be able to flip that in some time. So these aren't companies that really tend to flip, and a lot of them have been. You know, the market hasn't been too favorable to in the past. So that's when people say, "I want my money back in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years." That's not an easy thing, but. A lot of money being put for that purpose. So I at least wanted to raise that. But I couldn't have, you know, there's a lot here, and I agree with and appreciate all the work that Louisiana is doing on this front, and I hope that they lead. I will say this, though. The point was made, the call that you want to get, well, there's three calls I wouldn't want to get if I were running Louisiana. I wouldn't want to get one from Congress saying I have an oversight, you're an oversight target. I wouldn't want to get one from the Department of Commerce saying we're doing an audit. And the last one I wouldn't want to get is from the Department of Justice saying, we have a criminal reference for your office and activity. Those are all probably coming in some form or fashion for something in this program, given the dollars that are out there. You just don't want to be the one that receives that.
All right, so I will also respond. I think Mike and I feel like we're kind of looking at the same glass. I may see it more full and you may see it more empty. And I think it's a little bit more perspective than anything else. You know, I do think at the end of the day, you know, while I am completely fiber bullish, I think they will take every tool in the toolkit. I think it just will. There will be areas where you just have to use the right technology that makes sense for that situation. And I see it with my own guys who are doing, you know, who love fiber. But yeah, there's areas where fixed wireless has to be the solution until you can figure out how to get over that mountaintop or over, you know, that glacier barrier. I also think that, you know, so thinking through some of those pieces, but I do think, when I think about the last hurricane that came up through your neck of the woods, I reached out to my companies after that hurricane, and because they buried so much of their plant, they were like, yeah, we're okay. And, you know, that was kind of amazing, right? I mean, you know, when you're in an area like that, the ability to not lose that connectivity. Go ahead.
Yeah, so look, we've had our fair share of hurricanes. So in 2021, we had four hurricanes that hit Louisiana, two largely in southwest Louisiana near Lake Charles, sort of Texas-Louisiana border, and then two in the southeast part of Louisiana. The challenge with hurricanes is, hey, you know, these hurricanes aren't just spooling off the Sahara, the Sahara Desert in Western Africa and sort of have time to spend as these things plod along. Some of these hurricanes move the Caribbean and just shot straight up, you know, to Louisiana, and they're not getting any weaker as they move up Louisiana, which means the infrastructure is really exposed in the parts of Louisiana. But that is a big deal. There are 26 state parishes that are below Interstate 10. So we have Interstate 10, South Divide, Louisiana, Interstate 20, North Louisiana. In those 26 parishes, telecoms was post-Ida, it was really a wireless issue, but it was a big deal. And so as part of our calculus, we're trying to understand, based on unit economics, does it make sense to build a lot of this infrastructure underground specific to community anchor institutions, especially? And so we'll know within the next 3 to 5 months what those costs are, because I think there is impetus among the legislators in Louisiana to try to create more resilience when it comes to infrastructure resilience, both wireless and energy grid-related, especially in those areas south of Montana.
So the only last thing I would say to Mike's point about, like, yeah, if we could have all of my companies provide the service, I think we'd be in great shape. But they're small, and, you know, they can't do it. But one of the things that I think is really an interesting model, and I just wish people would focus on it a little bit more, and I've even talked to USDA about giving extra credit points, is partnerships and finding a way to encourage one of my companies, who's either a telephone cooperative or a community-based telecommunications provider, to partner with an electric co-op, or to partner with a municipality, or to partner with each other. And how do you create that scope and scale in a really interesting way? We see a lot of it. I've got a lot of great partnerships up and running in the last 5 years that are really meaning the communities are, you know, tens of thousands of people are getting connected because my guys bring the technical expertise. And an electric co-op, for example, may bring the footprint, may bring some of the finances, the ability for them, you know, part of it is you got to get over your ego to make it work, which is more challenging than you'd think. But on the flip side, I've got about 300 areas where my guys are sea-licking, meaning they are competitive providers into a larger area that's unserved, to the point where I get stories all the time about, like, people chasing their fiber trucks down the highway saying, when are you coming? When are you coming? You know, and then they're making business model decisions if they can extend into those markets. And that's where I think BEAD's going to be really interesting when they see what's left.
Shirley, I have a question for you. Your statistic of your companies cover 35% of the land and 6% of the population is quite striking and really makes you appreciate the issue. And so it's, you've got this last mile thing that we had with phones and we've had with all kinds of services. I mean, I guess I have two questions in quite different directions. Is one possibility that we should just recognize that, hey, there's nothing wrong with some areas not having access. In fact, that could become a point of pride. I mean, you know, people may move there.
Is this from the judge who makes his staff turn in their cell
exactly.
phones?
So I said I was going to do it from two different directions. So you understand which one is personal and which one isn't. So the personal one is, you know, this we're going to call this location Nirvana, and you can vacation there and be free. Your kids can come and they can keep their phones, but the phones won't do them any good. And, you know, you're going to experience these beautiful parts of the country. And so be it. Like, people can take pride. So question one is whether, what do we mean by uniform access? And do we really, really want to insist on it? Question two is quite the other direction. Are there more efficient ways to do this? I mean, you know, I'm not an expert in this area, but I'm aware of hotspots. And, you know, there's a part of me that thinks with all this money, buy a million of those gadgets and, you know, don't worry about it if it's so expensive. So how about both? How do you answer both of those?
All right, I'll take the first crack if anybody else wants to jump in there. So I don't. How many people in this room have ever actually gone on an African safari? Anybody? Yeah, and then you're like, wow, I have internet here. That is a drag. So I will say, for as much as we think about wanting to get off the grid, it's pretty tough. And I will say that when I think about, first of all, when you think about my areas, it is literally, if you are flying from DC today and you're going to California, you're looking below and you're like, there's a lot of land down there, not a lot of people, but there's a lot of agriculture. There's a lot of natural minerals. I mean, when you think about what drives part, there's food production. What drives part of the American economy really has become very broadband maligned. We've done sessions on bovine facial recognition. That is it's a real thing, and it's a big deal. When you think about how can we become more efficient in agriculture production? So I would say it might be nirvana for some. I would still say let's take away everybody's devices in this room and watch them lose their minds. So that would be one thing.
What does that last point prove?
Touche. And the second thing I would say about efficiency, it's another thing, when the pandemic started, a lot of people were like, oh, fiber, you don't need synchronous speed. You don't need to go upload as fast as you download. Well, try doing a Zoom session when you don't have synchronous speed. You live in Arlington. You have Fios.
You do. That's in. Okay,
so yeah, I wanted to make sure that Mike wanted to. I think we have learned that what would have been enough 3 years ago, and our thirst and hunger for, when you look at bandwidth expansion, we're just filling up those pipes. I mean, we're thinking of applications for all of them. But I will let Mike rebut.
I do think that traffic has increased and our desire for bandwidth has increased. Absolutely agree. Zoom actually takes a very small amount of data. So either, it's not like you need synchronous 100-100. You don't need synchronous. You actually can, do it in really low speeds. You can do it under 25. And actually 25.3 actually does fine for Zoom. So I hate when people use that example because it's not.
You're Zooming and then somebody else is on the VPN and then your kid is gaming in the basement.
Well, you were using Zoom. If you want to add other complications to your point, I do think the bandwidth is increasing. So I do agree with that wholeheartedly. But we haven't, and maybe we'll get there in terms of oversight. These programs are going to desperately need people and eyes on them. I know I see Randy May out there. He just has a new paper on oversight. We're really going to need everybody working on to make sure these dollars go really well. I really appreciate the work and the points that are being made in terms of what they want to do in Louisiana. Not exactly known as the most efficient government system ever, no disrespect.
You need to spend some time with us now. It's been a couple of years, Mike.
It's true.
So I would invite you to come down, and
it's true.
Happy to share some thoughts.
No, I hope that's absolutely true, and I hope that that's the case. I commend you for traveling around. There are efficiencies to be had overall. The second question from the judge: there are efficiencies to be had. You still have to connect to a network, so all the hotspots you want, they got to connect to something. And that becomes the cost piece that we're sort of talking here. There are efficient ways to give out the dollars. I prefer reverse auctions. They produce efficiencies. That's not the direction Congress wanted to go. I have to respect that.
But Vineet, I take it hotspots are not a great answer to a lot of your constituents.
Well, look, we're technology neutral as a state because it's not going to make any sense to spend $1 million to get to a fishing camp in Toledo Bend on the border of Texas, Louisiana, when the guy's there or gal's there only 2 days a month, right? That's not an efficient use of dollars. So from our perspective, we are technology neutral. And so that's why, based on the allocation, we'll work the math. We look at RDOF and we look at our CPF dollars. It's really down payments to solving the problem. And then whatever else is remaining, we'll use our B dollars to really string out any efficiencies and to make sure, again, if it's going to make sense to do fixed wireless, then maybe it makes sense to do fixed wireless. If there's some other modality or tool, then we'll do that. But the other thing is, at the end of the day, I have to certify, and this is what the feds say, I have to certify that everyone has access to something. I'm not certifying that someone's going to actually pay for something. That's not my job. That's frankly the ISP's job. It's the community's job because they have to show value.
the ISPs will hem and haw about adoption uptake, subscriber rates, and they're like, oh, it's not good enough. Well, this is their opportunity to start to show value, right? In much more than the functional needs for broadband, but how can it improve your lives both professionally and personally when you start to leverage it as a platform and an asset in different sectoral areas? That's the way we're looking at things from a Louisiana's perspective. Because I think we'll solve the functional needs, what percentage is fiber, satellite, or what have you. But what it's going to do materially to then drive Louisiana's economy, bend the healthcare cost curve, are things that we're really interested in learning between now, behaviorally, and into the future. So, we had a convening with ISPs yesterday, and we said, look, you need to help us understand what we can do to help drive adoption. But at the end of the day, if someone judge wants to be off the grid, then that's fine. But if suddenly one day, God forbid, we get into another pandemic and everything, God forbid, shuts down again, then that person that suddenly is not feeling well, that needs access to something, at least is available in a timely fashion. And that's what we're trying to do.
Well, pandemic also led to growth in homeschooling, but I'm pushing too hard on one side of this. Let me give one more question, and then I want to open questions to the audience. So, Vineet, one thing that's very striking to me about this, and I guess makes me nervous about it, not just the amount of money, but this one-time feature of it. So, whether it's, we're talking 40 billion, 60 billion, I mean, it's an astonishingly big number. And let's all accept that, just for the purpose of the question, that this is a good idea, right? It's a really good idea to give everyone access. And it might cost in that department. What's striking to me is technology, there's so much change in this area. So you have this snapshot of time of 60 billion over the next 5-10 years. Well, in 20 years, I mean, we have no idea what could be obsolete. And I'm just curious, Louisiana is so lucky to have you. I mean, are you thinking that we're not going to be getting this again, as people seem to agree, and we need to hold quite a bit of it in reserve because there could be a lot of change? I mean, we obviously want to meet the goals of Congress, but it seems so strange to spend all of your allocation of the money and then be almost assured that in 15 years there's some unforeseen thing that is now obsolete and you have no money to do anything about it.
Judge, 20 years is a long time. 6 months is a long time for me to think ahead. I mean, January of 2020, I was in New Orleans at the Superdome watching LSU beat Clemson. And then 2 months later, the pandemic struck. All right. That's why this is going to be a really fluid effort. Because
time is it going to be spent over? How many years? 5 years, all this money will be spent.
Well, that's the intent. But wow. 5 years is a pretty, it's ambitious to commit, because we have to commit and spend the money, right? Plus, we have our $176 million from ARPA that we also have to commit, but we now have to spend. So I think that's the challenges you have. Maybe 150 of us throughout the country that's going to manage the success of $42.5 billion. I mean, that's extraordinary. And you're going to start to see, as Shirley said, execution risk among state broadband leaders who are trying to intake as much as they can from the feds, intake as much as they can from stakeholders, intake as much as they can, and at the same time come up with legislation and policy so that they do avoid sort of the oversight issues that Michael talked about. But to your point, there's going to be risk reward in all of this. So I guess my point, Judge, is a year from now, I really don't know. I mean, who knows? Elon Musk's technology is in 5, 7, 10 years. Could be hyper-scalable. I don't know.
All right, let's get stuck with some questions. We'll start here on my right. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Adam Candid, Michigan State. I'm a professor of law there. And I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to upset anybody. But I think, to be honest, I think as classical liberals, as conservatives, the entire BEAD program should make us throw up. it's like the lunches and dinners at the Federalist Society convention, the wretched excess. This whole, it's 50, well, 40, let's see, all the add-ons is like $60 billion. And there has been, what do we learn in Law and Economics 101? There's no government intervention there's no subsidy without demonstrated market failure, and there hasn't been. There's not clear that there's any great need for it. Pache, Judge Sutton, I live in rural Michigan. It seems like all the 15-year-old boys can download pornography at adequate speeds without jitter. So, and furthermore, we may not even know if it's a good thing, as Judge Sutton pointed out. The work of Gene Twenge, of Jonathan Haidt, show that really broadband has been deleterious on our children's mental health and their intellectual development. But the big elephant in the room is, of course, the dynamic efficiency. Satellite has been excluded from this entire debate. And of course, I got signed up for Elon Musk's Starlink, and I had a wonderful sail around Lake Michigan for 2 weeks, and I had perfect reception. Even your clerks, Judge Sutton, might be happy with that. And so what we're doing, as Judge Sutton suggests, is that we're locking ourselves into a technology that will be inefficient in 10 years. And that's not just a waste of $50 billion now. It's a tax on our children going forward, because they will be paying for the upkeep of these networks when they can provide perfectly adequate services at a much cheaper rate. So, I guess as...
We take the statement and the... elephants in the room that you identified, but I know Vineet has talked about the mental health. I mean, maybe Vineet and Shirley could just brief response concerns.
Well, first of all, I would disagree with you because it's not from my perspective a liberal or a Republican perspective. It's the folks that I talk to. Remember, Louisiana is a red state. If you were in my shoes and talked to the folks that I talk to on a daily basis across the political spectrum, I think you'll learn to appreciate why people need this stuff. Now, whether they need fiber, whether they need satellite or fixed wireless, at the end of the day, they don't really care. What they need is something that's affordable, something that's better than what they have, and something that's reliable. Now, behaviorally, because we are technology neutral, companies apply to upgrade and do a variety of different things that's fiber related. So we're not going to fault a company for doing what they think is in their best interest, so as long as it follows our rules. Now, you do make a very good point, and the judge, you and I were talking about this. The unintended consequences of all of this stuff, imagine Louisiana, 1.5 million people getting access to internet, is going to be increased isolationism, mental health challenges. And these are things that we're actively talking about, what we could do to start informing people on what they need to do to start getting ready for this, including even for an older population, right? You're going to see more people doing DDoS attacks, cyber attacks, scams, all sorts of stuff. So it's conversations we're having with a variety of stakeholders on trying to figure out what, let's say, interventions, but what we could do to start messaging sort of the buyer beware of what could happen when you have an unintended consequence perspective.
Although I would say from the mental health perspective, I look at my 87-year-old dad being able to FaceTime during when he was in COVID lockdown and the ability to continue to connect. And I will say we see a huge amount of applications on the telehealth front. Not so much always for the diagnostic, like I have a, dye in my eye. Mental health is huge. And we've set up about 7 or 8 mental health centers across the country in local VA halls, connecting to the state VA offices for that very purpose. So I would say, what could be, it's both sides of the coin, right? It could be a blessing or it can be a curse. Telemedicine, the best application is honestly mental health, because you don't have the stigma of having your car out in a rural community in front of the mental health clinic. You do it from your living room, you do it from your iPad. It's been pretty interesting to watch. The other thing I will say is, having had the opportunity to be in the Rose Garden during the Infrastructure Act, the thing that people didn't realize is how bipartisan it was, because it wasn't cool to present that to the press. But I'm sitting there watching, Senator Capito high-fiving, Senator Blumenthal, and it's like, it really was this recognition that, if there's the 21st century highways, some of it is going to be highways, some of it is going to be bridges, and some of it is going to be, you know, the internet and what it can bring. And the last thing I would say is, how do you really feel about Elon Musk getting billions of dollars in federal support? I mean, he could spend it on Twitter, or he can spend it on internet access. But I think that's also a really interesting case, right? You know, you've got this multi-billionaire access to, you know, building networks. You know, how do we make those different calls aside from technology?
So Mike, can I jump in a couple points? And I you know, first, in terms of the size of the money, I can only say to you, it could have been 10 times worse. The numbers that were talked about.
Great comfort.
I don't mean to cut. That isn't right. I testified when the number was talked about was 100 to 200 billion. And I was like, you guys are crazy. I'm trying to be respectful to Congress. I'm like, the system can't handle that much. So they came to 40. I was trying to sell 20. And I thought that was outrageous. But they settled on 40 on just the BEAD program, and then have these other side programs because they want to be able to funnel money out the way they want to funnel it. So to their favorites, you know. But to your second point, I'm going to leave that to you in terms of telling people that broadband can be bad. I have suggested that in the past and been run out the door on a rail. That's not, anyone who wants broadband should have the opportunity. No one is required to use it. And I think that to the judge's point or judge's question earlier, I think that you'll have an option. There'll be no anti-broadband safe spot. You know, there'll be an opportunity to pop up a satellite dish and have connectivity if you want it. You can have a zone and you can agree amongst the participants not to have technology like you can mandate in your office, but that it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So we'll be able. In terms of your last point, if I wrote them down correctly, the anti-satellite. I am pro-satellite. I think LEOs are going to be really exciting. I'm pro what's going to happen. You know, Starlink is great, but think about what the 4 or 5 systems are coming. Amazon's got Project Kuiper, really exciting what could happen there. They're not talking about just serving the niche markets of tiny little unserved population. They might go, you know, nationwide or globe-wide in terms of what they could do. And I would venture to your point, in terms of maybe your second point. We all remember early, or maybe some of us don't, we were like, we've got to connect the schools to broadband. You're like, okay, then we got to get the classrooms connected to broadband. So on Saturdays, everyone would rush to the local school, and they drag the cables to everyone's classroom. And they did that for like 2 years. This is what I was in the House of Representatives. And you had to connect the classrooms. And then we realized that nobody needed it. You needed wireless. And it was all a waste of money in terms of connecting the schools with fiber or that time T1 lines. It was a way we could have, you know, and that's, we're going to find some of that here. And when people reject technology and they say fiber is the only solution, fiber needs a preference, that's what's going to happen in 5 or 10, 20 years from my perspective.
Let's go this side. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Sean O'Donnell. I'm a city attorney in Ohio on the second half of the judge's categorization. We're not one of the three C's. I don't want to identify which one before I ask this question because there's, I think there's spies of Attorney General Yost in this room. So I'm a city attorney, and we understand that the money has to be spent fast and spent accountably. But you know, our issue, and this may be a Louisiana-specific question, is how involved were the local county, I guess, parish governments, cities? Because the issue is our Ohio Revised Code has not necessarily caught up with the need for speed, so to speak. I mean, we still have prevailing wage. We've got competitive bidding. Once we give away, we can't just pick one of your companies, Ms. Bloomfield, and say, hey, you get these franchise rights and nobody else. How did they do that in Louisiana? Because we're wrestling with this question right now. Thank you.
That's a great question. So a couple of things in Louisiana. So we do have something called the Fair Market Act. So there are only two municipalities in Louisiana, one of which I think is selling their network that actually owns their own broadband infrastructure, municipal-owned infrastructure. And so that exists today. But one of the things that we heard when we traveled a ton throughout the state was this non-alignment in the parishes and the folks who were very frustrated, not only perhaps with their ISPs, but knowing who their ISPs were, right? They really didn't have a voice at the table for a long time. And so one of the things that we did was, as part of our scoring criteria for our dissemination of our 170 million, is that we said this. It's not a requirement, but we said, ISPs, go talk to the parish folks. Go talk to the parish administrators. And what we would do is we would actually award a point or two if they got a letter of support from the superintendent, or if they got a letter of support from the parish administrators, based on a vote, right? State procurement's not involved in our efforts because we wanted to streamline efforts. State procurement's not involved. And so when parishes would come to us and say, well, how do we select sort of the partners that we wanted to push? What we told them was, look, state procurement's not involved. You have to follow your own procurement effort. And so largely a large number of projects that were endorsed. And remember, the applicant for our money were not the parishes. They were either the co-ops or the ISPs. They were the only two applicants. And so they then presented their business case and said, look, we've done all this stakeholder engagement. We've talked to all these people in the parishes. We've got letters of support. Some of the parishes used some of their ARPA dollars as a match. It wasn't required. It was optional to really stretch out those dollars. So and they liked that, right? And so it gave them a sense of, they gave them a seat at the table, and I think they appreciated that, and we continue to vouch for those kinds of efforts.
Great question and answer. Thank you. I'm right.
Good afternoon. My name is Josh Baker. I practice law in Virginia. I represent property owners. And I've got a property kind of based question here. I think Mr. O'Reilly, you talked about the deployment issues. I think that last mile and the actual right-of-way acquisition is a really big issue and hurdle to the overall goal. And setting aside, is it good or bad as a goal? It's moving forward. Virginia has adopted some, frankly, I think unconstitutional statutes that rewrote every existing electrical or telecommunications easement in the Commonwealth to say, oh presto, all of a sudden, all those easements that have existed forever now also include a right to run fiber optic. No one can tell them no. The easement holders can't tell them no. And there's no limit on the number of ISPs that go into that existing easement. So I'm very curious to know what other states might be doing. I see this as a just fundamental problem with the whole rollout. Because most of these ISPs are not regulated entities. They don't go in front of Virginia, the State Corporation Commission. They don't have the power of eminent domain. And so we just kind of privatized and subsidized these companies to a huge degree to just go run roughshod over the Fifth Amendment. So I'm curious to know how that angle, if at all, has been considered in the rollout. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I would say this. I have read about the Virginia situation. I know it's been challenged, and I'm sure you're part of that process, right? But I would say that, you know, my experience is there's many more states are on the other side that either don't have a system of moving forward, that still rely on old structures and therefore deployment's much more challenging, or that are actually inhibitive to deployment. I have to bring the Shirley's companies, but her partners sometimes. Electric co-ops are not the most conducive to allowing anyone to enter their area. They have a natural monopoly. They're about 10 different favorite systems that we lay upon them. They have tax advantages. They've got rights of way access, all these other things at polls. And then they're willing to partner with somebody, you know, and that will get, you know, they can extend their favoritism to one company, but to nobody else. Or they want to build out themselves and nobody else can take advantage. That's a problem that needs to be addressed. And I hope that there are regulatory bodies and Congress can get in that space. But I understand your point in terms of property rights, and I can't speak to Virginia. There are very few, I think, that are so have been. The problem has been we want deployment, and it's, you know, it's that push pull. We talk about city process here and how, you know, for the longest time it was a barrier, and now some states and localities have recognized that and said, let's flip it on its head and then give all access, and you're pushing back. And finding that middle ground has been hard, and we have so much experience with the former and very little in the latter. To your point,
Mr. May, I think.
Yes, thank you, Judge. Well, I've known Mike O'Reilly and Shirley Bloomfield for decades and know how smart they are, so I'm hesitant to ask a question. And I've just seen Beneath for 45 minutes or so, and I can tell you're in the same category, but but I spent 6 months at Fort Polk, Louisiana, in the summer. So I've got this bias against Louisiana, despite LSU. And you would know what I mean if you spent some time at Fort Polk. Anyway, when Shirley spoke, and this is what caused me to pick up my pen, she said, and this is a pretty much a quote, I think we have the same infrastructure here in D.C. as in Montana. And by that, when you said that, I took that to mean a predisposition to fiber. I mean, obviously, we don't now have the same. But there's been a lot of discussion after I wrote that down. I think where there's been some recognition that all over the country in places like Montana and others that maybe fiber is not necessary everywhere, I think. So there's been some discussion. I want to move on and just make a couple other points. Shirley, you also said the funds.
Do your best to put it in a question form, if that's okay.
I will. Here's the question. You said that the money should be dispersed first to unserved areas and then underserved areas, and then I think you even had a third category. So my question here, then I've got one more, is I've always been puzzled by what really unserved means. And I think a lot of times it really is another way of saying overbuilding existing networks, really, that already are there. And to me, that's not an effective use of the money. So I want you to comment and others on that.
So there's a line. It works beautifully if you do all the questions at once. So let's do this one first. Shirley, you answer that last one.
Before I forget.
Exactly.
Because clearly whatever I say, I get in trouble for. But what I meant by that really is the idea that I still think even in Montana, you need fiber. But what I'm saying is that when you put that mile of fiber in, and the fiber, the cabling, the handholds, the pedestals, the software, the hardware, it's the cost is the cost, and it's the same cost. It's just the fewer folks that you have to spread that cost among. So that was my point on kind of saying that even if you were putting copper in the ground, it's the same thing. You just have a lot fewer people, which is one of the reasons why a lot of these programs, Universal Service was in the 1936 Telecommunications Act and codified in 96, because of the fact that it is just impossible in some of these areas to make that business case. But there was at least a recognition law that said all Americans, regardless of where you live, deserve access to comparable and affordable service. So I remember that part of the comment. I can't remember the second question.
That's fine. Well, Mr. May, you stay right there. Let's hear from the person on the right with one question, ideally.
But overbuilding, I want to ask.
We're very confident. We've got more to say.
Actually, my comment question is going to overlap a little bit. Keys off of initially Commissioner O'Reilly talking about the overbuilding, and now you're bringing it up. Let me give you a little case study, if you will. Actual client in Alaska, a very small town in the Aleutians, and they started a cellular company, built it a couple years ago, turned it up this year. Their major competitor under the Alaska plan gets $75 a month per customer of subsidy. They can't get it because they weren't there when the Alaska plan was adopted. They can't get rid of their competitor's $75 a month because it goes on until 2026. So there's no way they can compete on price. They got a $75 difference in revenues per customer that they're stuck with for several years. The same large company that has the $75 a month just got a reconnect grant to build a submarine cable to serve the area. Currently, it's all satellite. That company has proposed a price, and this is public, so I'm going to tell it to the FCC. I already have. The proposed wholesale price to my client is 8 times the other companies, the one that controls and owns the fiber, 8 times the retail price without any other cost considerations, just the backhaul. So what you're faced with is the possibility that retail competition is going to be hobbled. Now, my client is doing all of this with no subsidies. So this is maybe an underserved area. It's not an unserved area. But you face the prospect that the subsidies can actually eliminate retail competition. So any comments on, you know, what what the policymakers can do to ensure the subsidies don't eliminate retail competition, the law of unintended consequences?
Right. So look, I'll take some blame. I worked on the Alaska plan extensively. I own up to my error, you know, if there's one. I do think the subsidy should end when you have another competitor show up, and they don't. And the money that's going out the door in the $100 to $200 to $400 billion are going to go out, at least 80 in direct dollars are going to go out. That money's going to go into someone's pocket, and they're going to have that. It's not like you take it away at some point. They're going to have that advantage for the rest of their existence. They may spend it up, you know, and use it to build out their network and the areas that need service. But they, if there's money left over, they're going to have that money, right? So they're going to be able to use that against anyone coming in. Look, I've made the point that we should only subsidize areas where you can't economically, to the point, you know, where you have to actually, it makes sense to subsidize. Nowhere else. And you only subsidize one provider. And if someone else shows up, then how it should go with the existing subsidy, right? And that's a hard thing to turn off. So I agree. And if there's modifications that you made, that's where we should make the modifications in terms of how do you turn off the spigot when other people show up. But someone would argue, I suspect, that cellular provider is not sufficient because it doesn't offer fiber, and therefore it should, you know, can't turn off the spigot. They should get the 5G fund money, and so you can subsidize both of them.
And if I could just jump in on overbuilding, completely agree. Worst case of using any resources. The key is what is overbuilding, right? Because in a lot of these cases, what you'll get is that competitor come in, they take, you know, they take the donut hole because the donut hole is the density. What they're not doing is the donut. So you really got to make sure that when you think about that, you're comparing apples to apples in terms of what a competitor, because then you're cherry picking. Then you're taking off the anchor institution, you're taking off the dense customers, and what you're leaving is that ring of the highest cost, hardest to serve area. So I think it's really kind of making sure. So Randy, to your earlier point about overbuilding, definitely think it is a poor use. It is something we are very concerned about as we watch this money going out the door. And that is where I think unserved, you know where you're not served. Underserved is the one that is going to be super dicey to define. And that's when Vineet's going to have fun saying, is it 25.3? Is it 100 over 20? What is underserved? And I think that will be a challenge.
So in our case, just very quickly, you know, we've changed the speed legislatively in the state, but that doesn't mean that our priorities when we score these projects shouldn't focus on just the 25. Like, we would supersize the scores for folks that still have less than 25.3 speeds. But one of the things that we, you know, what we did in this behaviorally, again, in this first dissemination of dollars, is we had the ISPs define the project areas, knowing full well what they were going to do. And so one of the things we might do going forward is we define the project areas. And to your point, Michael, we may do a combination of reverse auction that gets us to a clearing price and then do something that's a lot more qualitative to get to a final, I guess, winner for that area. And that may include a project area that includes, as long as it meets what, the 80% unserved, that includes 10% underserved, and then 10% community anchor institutions to stretch out the economics to make that project palatable. Those are things that we're actively working through right now.
So I wanted, if I could just say one thing, which is what an honor it has been to have a front row seat with these three terrific panelists. I'm going to leave, but they're not, and you're not going to miss me. You would miss them, so we're going to let them go. Michael O'Reilly is going to handle for the next 15 minutes, but I will say as a compliment that it doesn't instinctively warm my heart to hear about a $50 billion program, which will be spent in 5 years, but I'm now confused because I'm now convinced that the people doing it are really competent, and so I'm now suspending that normal reaction. And I just one last point of privilege to prove what a hypocrite I am. I'm going to race out of here, and my head will explode if Uber does not work instantaneously. So, thank you very much.
Can I just compliment, you know, the judge's work there? Really, really appreciate his way he's framed this conversation. But I want to answer the overbuild question. I'm happy to take some blame, but I worked really hard when I was at the commission to prevent overbuilding. I put my neck on the line. And if you want to blame someone, blame the Congress and blame some of these committees that don't have a very broad perspective. Blame the Reconnect program that Shirley knows all so well. It went from, you know, an 80% threshold, now down to a 50% threshold. You know, 50% is allowed to be overbuilt. And I went to them. I said, this is when it was 80%. I'm like, that's crazy. You can't be having 20% overbuilt. That's awful. You're basically saying they're going to steal these customers. And they were like, well, and they had no good explanation. They just wanted to divvy up the money. That the way they wanted to go out, they wanted to make up the money, decide they wanted to be people who distributed the cash.
So I'll just ask this. I'll make it even in the form of a question. Could be a statement, but a question for Mike O'Reilly and others, because I think you mentioned oversight earlier, the need for a congressional oversight, maybe all of you. So do you think that one of or two of the areas that will be ripe for serious oversight will be the extent to which NTIA or the states, as this the money keeps flowing, attempts to impose some form of rate regulation that, again, that could be at the state level or, you know, and it might not be directly through, you know, say using those words, and also, or say other things like net neutrality. You know, we've been talking about the money and hopefully using it efficiently and getting people deployed, but what about concerns about these other conditions?
Sure. I mentioned them in my opening, and I think that those conditions will be scrutinized. I'm not a prognosticator necessarily on how things are going to shake out in the Congress. I do think there's a good chance that one of the bodies will be switch control. And I think maybe both. I don't know. We'll see. But if either does, then expect incredible oversight process, even if it's by one seat in either body. Those letters are coming. I've talked to the members, Republicans on the Hill, and they, you know, most of them were not involved in crafting the IIJA. Then, you know, most people don't realize the number of members involved in crafting the IIJA were about four, and there are four senators who were not on Commerce Committee. So they aren't really. You can say it's a good thing, bad thing. I say it's Congress's decision. It was, you know, blessed by them and then signed by the president, so it's law. But there's not a love for the document from a lot of members who were not involved. So I anticipate extensive oversight if one of the bodies switches. And therefore, I would suggest to any state involved, don't be the bottom five, because it's not going to be a fun universe. Question.
Hey there. I'm Marco Peraza. I'm a legal advisor at the FCC. Thank you guys. For being here and for all agreeing against overbuilding. I'm really happy to hear that. I just wanted to ask, one, Amazon and Starlink and others are serving every household in America with 100 over 20 service. Will you all be lobbying us to turn off the high cost money?
So I should say, I didn't realize you were here. I'm not engaging in any of your proceedings. I still have a ban. So I'm not, you know.
Sure, sure.
You know, but in general, the only thing I would say is Amazon is going to go in that direction. They don't operate service now. But I, you know, if you look back at my statements, I would be happy to turn off the subsidies and high cost. And Shirley and I reformed high cost once, and I won't be there, but someone else will have to reform it in the future to make, you know, to respect the how it's changed over time, would be my broad sense, without engaging in any proceeding.
And I would say thank you for listening to all of us coming in and to talk to you about the future of universal service proceedings. So you're probably saying, I'm kind of tired of it, so maybe we could go away. But I will say not in the foreseeable future. And I think part of it, too, is I think we're, you know, people get excited about, you know, Starlink and some of these other things. Think about how few of those satellites have gone up yet, though. I mean, so I think that we try to be futuristic and you try to be forward thinking on some of that. But I think a couple things. First of all, I think people underestimate how expensive the base stations are and how expensive the monthly, you know, it's $100 a month, $500 for the base station. And when, you know, they talk, Elon talks about the number of satellites going up to actually create that coverage. I think there's been like 35 satellites that have gone up so far out of like the 500 or whatever they're projecting. So I think it's going to be slower than we think. So I look at the current proceeding and I say, if the government is putting out the hundreds of millions in ARPA CAP, Reconnect, BEAD, and you all at the FCC are looking at the next 10 years, I think that's a reasonable time frame to be able to say, all right, that's another time to look back and say, all right, how did we do? What is, you know, what is the current lay of the land? What does high cost need? What do anchor institutions need? And maybe we are at that nirvana point. I think it'll still always be business case models that will be difficult to make and to sustain. But can you make it 10 more years and then we can kind of see where we are at that point?
More questions from the audience. We promised to stay a little bit longer.
Want to talk more railroads? I'm just kidding.
That's right.
Although the state of, I think it's Minnesota, actually has a law now that does not allow railroads to actually charge. It's pretty interesting. And I always got that under consideration. Yeah. Do you know they actually make you pay for watchers to watch the boring going on? Yeah, and you pay a lot for those.
We have a question at the mic.
Sure. I guess it's more of a comment. Jay Payne, I work for the state of Ohio. I see a lot of similarities in broadband and fiber, building digital infrastructure like we did in the 1950s and 60s with building highway infrastructure. So I draw a lot of similarities between the two. But back then, just like we're struggling now, where I'm helping out the state, was working with the boots on the ground, the municipalities, and having workforce available. I know it's been brought up by pretty much everyone on this panel, how to incentivize or encourage local stakeholders to own the issue, to encourage recruitment into community colleges or certain kind of programs. I know us in the state of Ohio, we provide funds for those getting industry credentialed programs as an incentive to try to encourage more workforce, but with the workforce being stretched so much in so many different industries, you can have all this money, but you can't do anything until you get people actually willing to do the work at the local level. So I'm just more curious of any other thoughts or things to consider when thinking about the issue.
You're so right. And you know what we're finding? So we've done a couple things. We're rolling out a partnership with Northwood Technical College in Wisconsin, which actually has done online virtual broadband training. And we're going to roll it out with them nationwide. You know, we're beneath Scott, the community colleges, it's great. But where they don't, the ability to do the online training. And then they've even got a way to do the virtual hands-on splicing and some of those things. Or you do it with one of my companies, giving a discount, and we're going to be doing a badging, because I talked to the Department of Labor and I thought broadband was complicated until I learned about apprenticeships, which made my head blow up. And they're complicated and employers get really, turned off by it. So we're going to be doing a badging process. So when you complete that fiber design program, you get a badge from Northwood, you get a badge from NTCA saying, yeah, I completed this course. And, trying to kind of make that training universal across the country, because the challenge I've got is my guys, to send your tech somewhere, it might be a 3-hour drive, and the ability to meet the workforce where they are, like you can do your training at night. So really trying to get that off the ground, and we're pretty excited. But what we're also finding is that pipeline. So we've put together a partnership with the National Rural Education Association on creating a K-12 program to take across the country. Because what we find is it's those high school kids that don't understand that this could be a great career. This is cool. Jobs in this space are really cool. And if you work for a community-based provider, you can start off as a line tech or a finance person or doing customer service. You can become the CEO because there's 50, 60, 75 employees. It's a great job in these communities. But what we're finding is putting together a format, working with the school superintendents to say, it's beyond school fairs, but you got to get kids starting to think about it, which is why I'm really excited about the work that we're doing with the Esports Association, because just like people used to support the baseball team, now my companies are sponsors of their esport teams, which are their online gaming teams, and the digital skills that these kids bring, my companies are now hiring the kids that they support on the team to be interns in the company, and they're their newest IT recruits. So it's a really cool way of seeing that pipeline, but you've got to almost take it and kind of show people what can be done. So we think about this a lot, because I couldn't agree with you more. All that money coming down, and like I said, right now we can't even find the workforce to do it. So I really worry in 2 years how we're going to find that workforce if we don't think about the pipeline sooner rather than later.
mean, in our case, so the governor worked with the legislature to put $10.5 million into the community college system, specifically for broadband workforce training. But you know, from an execution risk perspective, that's going to be a challenge because as these costs increase, right? Especially if you're cannibalizing talent and labor, and you're taking folks from Texas and other markets to build networks, those costs will go up, which then means does our dollars stretch as far as it should? So it really needs to take a very much a bifurcated approach, which is we need to really build capacity locally as quickly and efficiently as possible. I think we need in Louisiana over 5,000 people to construct, maintain, and operate these networks. And that's, you know, just broadband related. And then LA DOTD is going to need thousands of people. And every sort of department is going to need thousands of people to do the infrastructure work. So, you know, whenever we have stakeholder meetings, we often bring the community college to that meeting, bring the ISPs, and we basically say, ISPs, similar to what we did in Lake Charles last week, how many people do you think you're going to need over the next year? What kind of folks? Where are the gaps? And then can these community colleges quickly spool up programs to accommodate that?
I was just going to say, for us, we get the most success when we have a proactive local group of individuals, usually a community, who are spearheading, solving these issues, all the different buckets, all federal and state programs going through, especially the ones that relocated during COVID who were used to a suburban, urban lifestyle. They all of a sudden moved to a more rural part of the state. And all of a sudden, you've got a community organization that says, we want to solve this as a community together. That's where we see the most success.
Okay. Further questions that we may be able to screw up or ponder on? Join me.
I think Brian's given us the hook.
Yeah, people are all questioned out.
I think so. Well, I'd say thank my panel, but it's kind of, you know, appreciate the opportunity. Thanks so very much.
Appreciate it.